Capitol Report is a production of Senate Media Services.
On this week's program, a deep dive into Minnesota history, including an overview of the 39 governors' portraits hanging in the Minnesota Capitol, and a look into the lives and contributions of the state's first two governors, Henry Sibley and Alexander Ramsey. Stay tuned for this week's Capitol Report. Welcome to this week's program. I'm Shannon Lurkey. The Minnesota State Capitol is the seat of state government, housed in an historic and beautiful building. It is also a history and portraiture, housing the collection of gubernatorial portraits spanning more than 150 years. The official state portrait of Mark Dayton, the 40th governor of Minnesota, was recently unveiled in a ceremony held in the rotunda. It hangs in the west wing of the Capitol on the ground floor in a corridor with Governor Tim Pawlenty, Governor Jesse Ventura, and around the corner, Governor Arne Carlson. These are all portraits, though, paintings, not photographs. Why is that?
Well, the importance of oil on canvas is the permanence, because if you had a photograph, that's going to fade over time. And so the goal of the Minnesota Historical Society and the Capitol Area Architectural Planning Board is to have a piece of art that's going to be there for decades and generations to come. So you want something that's a traditional oil painting on a canvas.
These paintings differ remarkably over the years. Alexander Ramsey, Henry Sibley, those are small paintings. Some, like Governor Arne Carlson, are quite large. What explains the differences in the size and how these paintings are the decisions that are made?
Yeah, that's a really interesting story to tell about the portraits, because what you are looking at is you're looking at portraits from the 1850s all the way up to the present day. And so you get a really good story about art history and how portraits were done. So you have very traditional, very formal paintings from the 1850s, the 1890s, early 1900s, the traditional governor with the hand in the coat, you know, that type of thing. And then you start in the 1930s having a little bit more personalization of the governor. So Floyd B. Olson was the first kind of a little bit more less formal painting. He's portrayed standing in front of the Capitol. Capitol's behind him, and he's holding a microphone for the radio. And he was one of the first governors to really use that technology to have these statewide conversations over the radio. So that was kind of a nice little kind of a part of his administration as a governor, and a part of his personality, very charismatic, very outgoing.
I noticed in Governor Arne Carlson's portrait, there are two butterflies, a blue and a yellow bird. Also in Governor Jesse Ventura's, there's Rodin's The Thinker, and there's a train in the background. What do these symbols indicate?
Well, it really typifies some of their achievements as a governor. The process for the last several decades is the governor, when they finish their term of office, gets to select their portrait artist and also what they want to be portrayed as or how they want to be remembered in that portrait. So they work with the artist to work out some of those details. And so once again, if you look at some of the more recent portraits from the last 30, 40 years, you do have characteristics or things that identify that person's interest. So we can go back to Al Cui, who has horses in the background. Well, he's an avid horse rider and has been his whole entire life. So those are his horses that are being portrayed in that painting. And you have Arne Carlson as the butterflies. One is a butterfly you find in Sweden. One is a butterfly you find in Minnesota, because he has Swedish roots. He's a Swedish-American descent. So it makes the things very personalized for these governors to have those stories told in the portraits.
As you view all these governors' portraits, some are seated at or near a desk, some have books or flags. Governor Tim Pawlenty and Governor Mark Dayton, as is Governor Floyd B. Olson, outside. How are the settings chosen?
Well, that's a kind of a conversation between the artist and the governor. So they can pick and choose what they want as their setting. And for instance, with Pawlenty, you know, that typifies this was the center of government, this is where he worked, this is where all of his achievements were made, was in that Capitol. With Governor Dayton, it's really acknowledging, you know, the importance of the state Capitol, but he was also the leading official that led the preservation, restoration, repair of the Capitol. So that's a part of his legacy. That's something that you want to be remembered. Not only did you serve here, but it's a place that you helped preserve for future generations.
One portrait is distinctly different from the others, and that's the one of Governor Rudy Perpich, because it includes his wife, Lola. What's the story behind that?
Well, the tradition for any governor portrait is to have just the governor as the person in that portrait. Governor Perpich had served non-consecutive terms, so he did have his first official portrait on display here, but because he had served a second term, he wanted to have that first portrait and a new portrait on display in the Capitol. And the Capitol Area Architectural Planning Board said, well, you can only have one representation. And he wanted to have his painting with his wife, Lola. And so that brought up this whole controversy about it should be just the governor. And so he was asked not to have her in that painting. And so he had a campaign, basically put billboards on University Avenue, you know, saying that they're not letting me and my wife in the building. So, you know, it just became kind of a sticky issue for several years. And then after he passed away, the family and other supporters got money to do a portrait with Lola in that painting. So you'll see Lola and Rudy in the same painting today.
Each one of these portraits has a plaque next to it explaining the accomplishments of that governor's administration. Who writes those?
That's overseen by the Minnesota Historical Society. So we contract with historians or other people to write those biographical plaques and the information.
Is the content ever controversial?
That's the problem. If you have portraits of living people or being portrayed, sometimes it's hard to really tell their story because they're still living that story. So sometimes that can be a controversial issue. With the older governors, you know, you have a little bit of time to really see what the permanence of that legislation they might have been supporting, the effect that has. So you have a better idea of the impact that that governor did have, you know, 100 years ago.
In a sense, these portraits tell the history of the state through time. What do visitors, do they comment ever about these portraits?
There's a lot of people who will, you know, as they're walking through the building, are curious. They want to see who these people are. They know some, they recognize some from their lifetime, and so they're interested in reading about them and seeing them portrayed here. And people usually comment, it's nice to see these portraits here because it does reflect that history of Minnesota and the different people that has served as that executive officer.
Figure from Minnesota's territory days through its early statehood is Henry Hastings Sibley, the state's first governor. Henry Sibley played a significant role in Minnesota history. He served as the territory's first representative in Congress. Of the territory of Minnesota, he was Minnesota's first governor. He helped frame the state's constitution, and he had a good relationship with the Dakota people when he worked in fur trading. How did Henry Sibley come to call Minnesota home?
He started out as a young man coming to Minnesota as a representative of the American Fur Company. He was 23 years old when he was given the responsibility to be kind of the representative of the headquarters for that fur company in Minnesota. And so he, you know, built a house in the 1830s eventually across from historic Fort Snelling, and really became an iconic figure for not only the people that were coming into visiting, you know, visit what would have been Minnesota at that time, and also had a strong relationship with a lot of the native people, especially the Dakota people that he was working with to get the furs back into his company.
Henry Sibley had a relationship with a native woman, and that produced a daughter. Her name was Helen. His work also with fur trading dealt with a lot of Native American people. How did those relationships influence his views?
Well, I think he was living in both worlds because, you know, his customers were the Dakota people or anyone else that was bringing in the supplies and the goods that he wanted, you know, especially the fur. And so he would spend time with a lot of Dakota people out hunting, going on expeditions. You know, he's pretty well known for, you know, his relationship with the Dakota people. In fact, his nickname was Walker in the Pines. And so, you know, they accepted him as, you know, almost one of them. But of course, as more people move in and to, you know, colonize or take over the land, you have to divide your loyalty to, well, I'm a white person, so I want to talk about more about the influences I have with that population, because the Dakota people or other Native people, you know, they're important, but they're not, by the 1840s and 50s, the fur companies are kind of losing their popularity. Fur companies are losing business. And so it's like we kind of have to move on from that chapter into the next chapter of Minnesota's history.
This part of the United States was undergoing great change. What did the territory look like in 1851, about a decade after the failure of the American Fur Company?
It was expanding rapidly. You have the Treaty of Traverse des Sioux, which Henry Sibley had a vested interest in. A lot of the Dakota, by the time of those treaties in 1851, were in incredible debt to the American Fur Companies. And so as these treaties take place, the traders are insisting that they get a payment of that treaty to pay off those existing debts. And so that, you know, complicates some of the interactions he had with Dakota leaders, because they felt they were being cheated out of some of their money. But you have to look at this idea that people are progressing. And so either you're progressing with this or you're part of the problem. And so Dakota people were in the way. So we have to take that, you know, buy that land, purchase that land, and put them on reservations. And then hopefully they become acculturated and become part of our civilization. And that leads to a lot of resistance, obviously, because people are not always willing to bend to the will of a greater power or, you know, a group of people saying you have to be this way.
Sibley was sworn in as governor in May of 1858, just days after the state officially became a state. So what were some of his accomplishments as governor?
Not a lot, in the sense of, you know, 2 years isn't a lot of time. That was the standard until all the way up to the 1960s. Governors only served 2-year terms. And so he was elected in October of 1857, so he didn't quite have 2 full years, but he was one of those governors that was faced with all kinds of economic hardships within the new territory and the new state of Minnesota. So he ended up that first year as a governor with a $5 million loan debacle, which was the constitutional creators decided in the Constitution the state can only borrow $250,000. So you can't lend out more than $250,000. Well, they wanted these railroads so badly in Minnesota to help the prosperity and the progress that they decided to change the Constitution just months after it was adopted by the citizens of the new state of Minnesota. So they got the legislature to, you know, make that Constitution amendment pass. The public voted for it to pass. And so they started trying to give out these certificates to these railroad companies, which at the same time there was an economic panic. One of the great panics of American history, where everything, all the investments that were brought into Minnesota got sucked out almost immediately. So the bottom line was they gave these companies these loans for $5 million and only a few miles of railroad were ever built. So that was a debt we had to pay off until the 1880s. And so that really strapped Sibley as a governor trying to kind of rectify that horrible situation. So what happened as a result of that is his political opponents kind of tried to paint him into a corner that he was at fault for all these kind of hindrances to Minnesota's progress. And he was actually against it. And so he was even fighting, you know, releasing these bonds to these companies, but the court overruled him. And so that's kind of his legacy as the $5 million loan. But, you know, you can credit him. We have our L'Etoile du Nord, our Star of the North symbol, and our state model. That's something that he created with the idea that we can be a guiding light for other states to follow. So as for accomplishments, there really was a lot he was able to do in that 2-year time period. So.
Both Henry Sibley and Alexander Ramsey ran for governor for the first, you know, gubernatorial election. Henry Sibley won. How did that impact their relationship?
When Alexander Ramsey was the first territorial governor, when he came to Minnesota, he had no place to stay. So Henry Sibley invited him to stay at his house until they could find a place for him to live in St. Paul. And so they were political, you know, antagonists for many, many years. In fact, that first state election for governor, Sibley and Ramsey were competing against each other, and Sibley only won by 240 votes. So it was a really close election, And there's, of course, allegations of fraud and that type of stuff, and probably was. But it's one of those things where I thought, you know, they were political opponents, but I think they had a relationship, a friendship. In fact, when the U.S.-Dakota War began, Alexander Ramsey came to Henry Sibley's house and said, "I need you to lead these troops because you're the, you know, most skilled at working with these Dakota people because you had engaged and interacted them with them for decades. And so we need you to help put down this this war that's taken place in Minnesota." Eventually, they were able to end the war. Chief Little Crow at that time was pushed out and his followers left with him. But as part of that conversation of what do we do with the people who were considered peaceful or really didn't have a role in that, they were put in at a camp at Fort Snelling, basically a concentration camp, and some people say an internment camp, just because by virtue of that war taking place, they were going to abrogate their treaty. They're basically saying, you did all these bad things, now you can no longer live here. So they were exiled from the state of Minnesota eventually. So he was a proponent of that. He was a proponent when they did these military trials of hanging over 300 men that were part of those battles, or alleged, you know, people who were killing people, white people in particular. And so, you know, he was, I think, you know, part of the idea that justice has to be served, and based on what I've heard, these people are guilty, even though historians have argued since those days that the trials that were conducted for the Dakota people were not fair, and it's pretty evident that that was the case. But he was in that situation of people were asking for justice in Minnesota. We have 600, and you know, at that time they thought it was 1,000 people killed, and it's like, where's the justice? Somebody has to pay the penalty for all these deaths. And so that's kind of the emotion that was generating throughout the state of Minnesota. Someone has to pay for that. And so the Dakota men that were found guilty were the best choice for that, that opportunity for frontier justice. But the other part, Lincoln weighed in and said, a lot of these guys were just participants in battles, so why would I execute them? There's no reason to do that. So that's where they, from the 303, you know, deemed of capital crimes, that list was pared down to 38. And so that's, and unfortunately for Minnesota, that's the largest mass execution in U.S. history in our state. And that was in 1862, so.
Much of Henry Sibley's contributions were made outside of public office, but are they still significant?
Oh, absolutely. You know, he was the first territorial delegate in 1851 for the Minnesota Territory. He was an early founder of, you know, our state, basically one of those guys who was part of the Constitutional Convention. So, you know, he got his political experience in the 1850s up until, you know, after, you know, politically he was pretty much done after 1860, but he was a member of the community of St. Paul. He was the president of the St. Paul Gas Company. He was, you know, the part of the Board of Regents for the U of M. So yeah, I think his legacy was, part of it was he was one of those first people here, first European American, Anglo-American people here. So he kind of paved the road for what would happen in Minnesota in the future, just because of his, you know, working with the Dakota people, being an important part of kind of the political atmosphere in the early history. And so I think that tends to be romanticized. And you always think of all these great accomplishments that he did have, and we can't take that away from him. He did have these accomplishments, but like we've talked about, you know, there's always good and bads. And so he's really a man of that time where he has to make decisions, tough decisions, you know, how do I best operate my business and still treat people fairly? And so, you know, the way I look at it, he saw everything as either, you know, there's a sense of justice, and if something isn't, you know, the way it should be for justice sake, there has to be something that remedies that. And obviously that's where the trials and all those decisions were made about the Dakota people. But it's one of those things where it's hard for him, I think, you know, or even us today to look at, and we can see all the bad things, but there was also a lot of the accomplishments as well.
Another prominent figure in Minnesota's early history is Alexander Ramsey, a wartime governor who served as both a territorial governor and the state's second chief executive. We are standing next to the portrait of Alexander Ramsey, who was Minnesota's second governor. But that governorship was not his first executive role in Minnesota. What was his first role?
He was appointed when he was a 33-year-old post or past House member from Pennsylvania as the new territorial governor for Minnesota in 1851. So that was his first executive role. He helped create basically the foundation for, you know, the territory moving into statehood.
Not only was Alexander Ramsey the first territorial governor, he was also the superintendent of Indian Affairs. So how did that work? I mean, he's trying to recruit people to Minnesota. There is a native population already here. There's kind of a conflict right from the get-go.
Yeah, it's a real tough situation for the native people because this is their traditional land. They've been living here for decades and centuries, and so now you have a new group of people saying, you can't live your lifestyle and you have to become one of us. You have to become civilized, as they would say, or become a farmer, or get rid of your hunting traditions, become like we are. And so in order for them to do that, you have a strong acculturation program that Ramsey was in favor of, as were most people in Minnesota. So that was a difficult situation in the 1850s, which eventually leads to a very tragic part of our state's history as well.
During Ramsey's tenure as governor, two major conflicts broke out. The United States began its Civil War, and the U.S.-Dakota War of 1862 began. How did these two big events impact Minnesota?
Yeah, those were key events. I'll start with the Civil War. Alexander Ramsey was in Washington, D.C., trying to get a political appointment for some of the Republican friends of his because he knew some of those people in Washington, D.C. So Fort Sumter was fired upon. He got that information, and he tendered 1,000 men from Minnesota, basically offered to the president, we will give you 1,000 men. And that was the first official tender he got, the president did. And so that was a claim to fame that Minnesotans would carry with him and still do today. But he was also in 1862, everyone was shocked when the U.S.-Dakota War began. That began the summer in August of 1862. And hundreds of people were being killed on the prairie or on the southwestern part of the state, and people are panicked. There's thousands of people. 23 counties vacated, were completely vacated of any people because they're fearing for their life. And so he had to recruit and get soldiers put together. He had Henry Sibley, a friend, but also kind of a political rival at that time, to lead military forces to quell or to shut down that U.S.-Dakota War.
Following the U.S.-Dakota War, Governor Ramsey addressed the legislature and said, I quote, the Sioux Indians of Minnesota must be exterminated or driven forever beyond the borders of this state. How aggressively did he pursue this policy?
That pretty much happened. The Dakota people were exiled. 38 of the Dakota men that were accused and found guilty of participating in that war were hanged in Mankato. The remaining Dakota people, there were about 1,600 to 1,700 that were put into a camp outside of, under the bluff of Fort Snelling, and then eventually moved to a new reservation in South Dakota. So because of that six-week war, the Dakota people lost everything. And so he basically fulfilled that statement. And you have to remember too, he's in the emotion, as the whole state is, of trying to react to this situation where you have 600 people. And they were thinking it might have been 1,000 people had been killed, and there's these bodies laying on the prairie that no one can account for. And so there's this desire, we have to stop this. You know, somebody has to step in to do something. And so that was the answer. And in the minds of a lot of these people in Minnesota, as a result of that war, they saw that the Dakota people invalidated any right to be here because of what had happened.
From our modern perspective, though, Alexander Ramsey's legacy is troubled because he made a lot of money in real estate, and yet there's this conflict with the native people. How important is it to have this sort of understanding of early statehood as we move forward?
Yeah, he was, as were a lot of people coming into Minnesota, they were here to make money, And so he saw those business opportunities. He was under even an investigation. He was accused of getting maybe more money than he should have for negotiating the treaty with the Dakota at the Treaty of Traverse des Sioux and Mendota. And so there was a congressional investigation. He wasn't found guilty of anything, but there were people that were like, we're not sure about how this, the dealings, the wheeling and dealing took place, and that he made $10,000 for brokering that deal, basically. So there's always those questions about motivation.
Towards the end of Ramsey's term as governor, the legislature elected him to the United States Senate. What else did he do politically for the rest of his time on earth?
Yeah, he served as a senator until the 1870s. He, after that, was appointed as a Secretary of War for Rutherford B. Hayes's administration. So he served there for a couple of years. And then later on, there's an issue in Utah about polygamy. And so he was appointed in the early 1880s as one of the commissioners to help resolve and basically outlaw the idea of polygamy. So that's kind of his post-governorship political career.
As we look back at these historical figures, our lenses change over time, and one lens that we apply now is that of mental health. And Alexander Ramsey had some traumatic things happen. His brother, his father committed suicide, two of his three children did not survive their childhood. What was it like for people back then without modern medicine?
Yeah, it was difficult. I think there was almost a sense of fatalism, because you knew if you had 6, 7, 8 kids, not all of them would survive to adulthood. And so that was something I think we often overlook, is the sense of grieving and how pervasive that would have been. Think about this. You have hundreds of thousands, millions of people who have lost loved ones in the Civil War. Plus you're losing children and grandchildren. So, you know, these people had to deal with a lot of loss. And so that would have been difficult for Ramsey and Anna, his wife, as well as, you know, the family, losing a brother, children, husbands, you know, everything that you can think will happen in the 1880s, 1890s, because there was no way to treat illnesses with diseases, per se, or infections. And also a lot of this was mental health. And so that's, you know, still trying to figure out how that's, you know, supposed to work for people today.
Join us again next week as we delve into more topics affecting Minnesotans. I'm Shannon Lurkey, and on behalf of all of us at Senate Media Services, thanks for watching.